Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the abolitionist John Brown. David Reynolds is our guest. His latest book is John Brown, Abolitionist, the Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. David Reynolds argues that Brown, who he says went to murderous extremes in his abolitionist fight, sparked the Civil War to a degree that no other American did. Reynolds says the Civil War and emancipation might have been slower in coming had Brown not acted as he did, murdering 5 people in Kansas, liberating slaves in Missouri, and raiding the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. The book, which Reynolds calls a cultural biography, asks some intriguing questions about Brown and his tactics that resonate with us today, including, when does principled resistance become anarchic brutality, and how can a murderer be viewed as a heroic freedom fighter? Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. David Reynolds is Distinguished Professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College at the City University of New York. He is the author of 2 previous books, Walt Whitman's America and Beneath the American Renaissance. His new book, John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights, is published by Knopf. Professor Reynolds, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me, Celeste.
Sure.
Wonderful to be here.
Maybe to begin with, you would talk with us about your choice of verbs for the subtitle, killed, sparked, and ceded.
Yeah, the reason I say killed, he didn't really end slavery because that happened, with the amendments that were passed about 5 years after his death. But when he attacked Harper's Ferry, the commotion caused by that, the polarization and the effects of that, the ripple effects of that, set in motion the process that helped to end slavery. And a fellow abolitionist, Wendell Phillips, said that as a result of this event, slavery is like a fallen pine tree. It's still green, but it's dying from the roots. So in that sense, that's the sense really that I use killed. And then sparked the Civil War. I try to argue, and a lot of reviewers agree with me that basically there was incredible combustible material in America at that time. It was almost like an open gasoline, a tank or something like that. And he is the one who provided that final spark that really created this intense polarization, and within 19 months the Civil War broke out, causing the deaths, of course, of over 620,000 Americans, more Americans than in all other wars combined. And then ceded civil rights, the idea of ceding civil rights, there's a direct line from John Brown through African-American writers and reformers in the 2 or 3 decades after him, leading right up to the NAACP and the most important early meeting of the Niagara Movement, which was W.E.B. Du Bois's movement that gave birth to the NAACP, which in turn gave birth to modern civil rights. That meeting was held at Harper's Ferry, and it was in honor of John Brown. W.E.B. Du Bois specifically said that I want to dedicate my movement to the man who died for my race, for African Americans. So that's where I get the idea of seated civil rights.
Hmm. You open the story at a party on the day of the Emancipation Proclamation. The proclamation being signed on January 1st, 1863, and the party was held in a mansion, the home of George Stearns. And while they celebrated Lincoln's proclamation, they were people who had their doubts about Lincoln. Would you talk with us about that and tell us about their racial views and how it was, maybe we're getting a little ahead, maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but about how Lincoln saw Brown.
Right. Well, the reason that a lot of people at the party had doubts about Lincoln was that he was sort of a latecomer to emancipation. His initial, he hated slavery just as much as John Brown did, but his initial reason for going to war was to preserve the American Union after the South had seceded, the Southern states had seceded. And then slowly he did make it a war for emancipation. He was very much a constitutionalist. He wanted to try to work within the Constitution. He reluctantly went to war and did so only after the firing on Fort Sumter. And it's not that he didn't like, he obviously hated slavery, but he was a colonizationist, someone who wanted to emancipate the blacks and then ship them abroad to Liberia or Central America because he believed that they couldn't get along with the whites in America, that the races just would never coexist equally in America. So that's why a number of people at the party had certain doubts about Lincoln, and it was called the John Brown Party because John Brown was isolated as really the person who had been the martyr for blacks. He had lived among African Americans. He had died for Frederick Douglass, the greatest black leader of the 19th century, said, "I lived for black people. John Brown died. He gave his life for black people." And so that's why that party was held on the day of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm. Now, everyone there at that party was, as you say, joined by an idealistic vision of a man who in other circles was branded as a murderer, a thief, and an insane fanatic.
Yeah.
Talk with us about how Brown was seen north and south by whites and blacks.
Well, when he raided Harper's Ferry, he raided it with 21 men hoping to free the slaves there, liberate them, and flee to the mountains. And instead, he was captured and later hanged. And initially, the North totally rejected him. Why? Because the North was basically pacifist. Most of the abolitionists were non-resistant pacifists. And the South, ironically enough, found him very cool and courageous, and most of the early praise came from the South. Obviously, the Southerners hated what he stood for, but they were a macho culture. The South at that time believed in the Southern gentleman, the idea, and that included this kind of machismo and aggressiveness and violence and dueling, bowie knives, that kind of thing, the family feud, killing each other off and so forth, and lynching. So ironically, in those very early days, they said, this guy's actually a pretty cool dude, even though obviously we hate his guts. And the North said, who is this crazy jerk? You know, he's ridiculous. But then the leading intellectual of the North, Ralph Waldo Emerson, said, when John Brown dies, he will make the gallows as glorious as the cross. And comparing him to Jesus Christ, and Henry David Thoreau did the mm-hmm. same thing, and Bronson Alcott, these very influential intellectuals, suddenly were comparing him to Jesus Christ, and suddenly the North did a complete flip-flop and said, no, wait a minute, John Brown, look what he did. Maybe he is much more heroic than we thought, and maybe in his case the violence was actually justified. And when that started happening, of course, the South completely demonized him, and then that very, very intense polarization came about so that even people like Lincoln were called John Brown supporters on the part of Southerners started, tarring Abe Lincoln, even with the John Brown Harper's Ferry thing. Meanwhile, Lincoln hated the idea of Harper's Ferry, even though he admired John Brown's heroism and so forth. So, and also the story of the Pottawatomie Massacre mm-hmm. in Kansas, where John Brown a few years earlier had raided these cabins at midnight and murdered five pro-slavery people, that began to be played up in the press. And so then in some circles he was considered a horrible murderer. Although at that time in the North, increasingly he was venerated. So that song, John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul keeps marching on, was the most popular war song that was sung by the Union troops as they marched south to try to free the slaves.
Yeah, and the melody would go on to become the battle hymn of the Republic.
Yeah, it goes, glory, glory, hallelujah. Yeah. And Julia Ward Howe heard that the John Brown song being sung in Washington, and she woke up at 4 in the morning and said, I'm going to really write a song about America, the battle hymn of the Republic, based on John Brown, on the John Brown song.
Speaking of ironies, John Wilkes Booth held John Brown in esteem. He disagreed with his politics, but he held him in high regard.
There were a lot of correspondences between John Brown and the Civil War because he was captured by Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart, who were leaders of the Confederacy. Stonewall Jackson was at his hanging, and so was John Wilkes Booth, John Wilkes Booth was like a ham bone actor of the day. He's like a, in a way, the good-looking, Brad Pitt of his day. His father was a great actor, but he was sort of a, melodramatic actor, and he saw John Brown hanging there. And obviously, John Wilkes Booth hated everything that John Brown stood for, but in his diary, not long before he killed Lincoln, he said John Brown was the grandest man of the 19th century, the grandest man. Why? Because he changed history with a single stroke. And this is what John Wilkes Booth wanted to be to do himself. He wanted to change history with a single stroke, but he wanted to be John Brown in reverse.
Hmm. Brown, you say, was a devout Calvinist. He believed he was predestined to stamp out slavery. He was, you say, a true Puritan. What should we know about his religious views in light of the fact that later he's compared to Christ?
Yeah, well, as a devout Calvinist, the Puritans who settled New England were basically Calvinists. They believed in an angry, judgmental God, the God of the Old Testament, basically. And they believed in predestination, the idea that God determines everything. And John Brown accepted this point of view, and he believed that he was actually predestined to stamp out slavery. He accepted this notion of the angry God, and he thought that the angry God really spoke through him, that God was angry, not at Southerners per se, but just at the immoral institution of slavery. So actually, John Brown befriended most of his Southern captors that in jail. In fact, he didn't want to be freed from jail because he didn't want the Southerners to get hurt. So it's not that he hated Southerners whatsoever. It's just that the institution of slavery to him was completely immoral. And so he believed that God was really speaking through him.
Yeah. He believed that the Sabbath was to be strictly observed, but he chose Sundays to stage his raid in Kansas and on Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, that was kind of, well, it was ironic, but I guess from his point of view, I think he was making a point. And the point was that on God's day, that's the day that this great foul stain of slavery, which involved the enslavement of nearly 4 million African Americans, that was the day that he chose to try to do his part to stamp it out.
Yeah. The commandments, keep holy the Sabbath and thou shalt not kill. How did he reconcile?
Yeah, I know. Well, he initially had been a pacifist, and he had a conscientious objector against going to the army and so forth early on. He was not by nature violent, but what happened was that in the 1850s, all the laws of that day, the Fugitive Slave Law, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and the Dred Scott decision were increasingly closing the vise on blacks, excluding them from society, denying them rights. And at the same time, violence was increasing in Kansas, where the pro-slavery party was coming over the border from Missouri and taking over the polling booths in Kansas and electing these fraudulent pro-slavery governments and using quite a lot of violence. And of the 36 murders committed over the slavery issue, 28 of them were committed by the pro-slavery side. So he was really retaliating against the overwhelming violence of the pro-slavery faction. And that's how he saw it. He was just pushed to the edge by the eternal bullying and violence and murder. And also he saw slavery itself as a state of war against an entire race, that slavery itself was a system of torture, of rape, of murder, and of enforced labor without pay.
Yeah. When did John Brown begin to hold slavery in contempt?
From a very, very early age. His parents were abolitionists, and he was born in 1800, and at age 12, when he saw a slave boy being beaten, he went to a family that happened to hold a slave, and he started playing with the boy, and you know, it was having fun, and the boy is very intelligent, and more so, John Brown thought, than he himself. And yet he, as a white boy, was accepted at the dinner table and coddled and praised, whereas the black boy was shoved outside and beaten with a shovel and other household instruments. And he said, from that moment on, I swore eternal war against slavery, even though at that time he wasn't yet, he didn't know that he was going to use violence someday. But at that point, you know, he thought that maybe he'd use other kinds of persuasion or something against slavery. But really, from a very young age, he was anti-slavery.
Yeah. His parents seem to be quite interesting people. Owen Brown and Ruth Mills Brown, married 1793. They moved to the frontier in 1805. And I wonder if their view, their relations with the Indians who were living there also helped shape John Brown's ideas about human dignity.
Yeah, they were a very racially open family. They believed in kind treatment of the Native Americans. John Brown played with Native American children and reportedly was went through a kind of mock initiation ceremony into a tribe of children and so forth and learned some of the Native American language. And when he grew up and was a farmer, John Brown, you know, a neighbor of his came over and said, look, let's you and I get together, get our rifles out, and let's shoot these Indians off of our property, because there were some Native Americans living nearby. And John Brown said, I'd rather take my rifle and shoot you off my property. You know, he hated any form of racial discrimination, and it really began with his relationships with Native Americans.
Hmm. What were his early efforts in the fight against slavery?
His earliest efforts were through the Underground Railroad, which was that process whereby escaped slaves were directed north. And so he would fairly regularly take fugitive slaves into his house, hide them, and then pass them north. He also taught African-American children, even though he had 20 children of his own, although only 8 of them outlived him. But anyway, he had a full family of his own, but he still took time to try to educate African-American children. And later on, he became involved in, well, he founded the League of Gileadites, which was an armed league of blacks. This was after the Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, and blacks were being chased, hunted down in the north. And so he formed a group in Massachusetts of armed blacks and encouraging them to use their arms if there was any attempt at capture of them.
Yeah. So then it's by 1850 he is consumed. The abolition is a consuming passion for him.
Yes, yeah, consuming passion. And at that point, he moves up to North Elba, New York, in a farm among a huge colony of African Americans, most of them ex-slaves, fugitive slaves living up there in the open countryside. Why did he move up there? Because he wanted to help spur the economy, the local economy, to make them productive, to help them learn farming techniques. And that's where he chose to live, and that's where he chose to be buried. That's where he is buried.
Yeah. Tell us about the speech Brown gave on January 15th, 1851. Quite amazing. And his audience were blacks. And one can, you know, you do this in your book. You imagine what it was like to be there and to hear this call to arms.
Yeah, I mean, in effect, the only comparable thing before this was were like David Walker's appeal. David Walker, of course, was an African American orator and writer who said, "Rise up, my brethren," you know, even if you use arms and so forth. But John Brown was really the first white person. It's interesting because a lot of people today even think of John Brown as being black. But I think the reason that a lot of people think that is that since he did live among blacks and he gave this speech in which he said, you know, my brothers and sisters, he was also a women's rights advocate, he said, you really must arm yourselves and be prepared to kill somebody if you are being unfairly dragged down. He was so against the fugitive slave law, whereby even if you were in Boston and if you had managed to escape slavery, that you could be dragged back into slavery, put back into chains, and sent out into the cotton fields again. So, yeah, he gave this very, very militant speech to this group of blacks.
Hmm. How many black people then took up arms with John Brown?
He held a convention in Canada in which there were scores of black people, and he encouraged them to join him. And Harriet Tubman actually wanted to. She was a famous black leader in the Underground Railroad, and she wanted to join him at Harper's Ferry, but apparently was ill and couldn't make it. He asked Frederick Douglass to join him, but Douglass thought it was going to be a suicidal mission, which in effect it turned out to be. But in the end, five African Americans joined him. So there were five African Americans, and then there were 16 whites, including John Brown, among the band that raided Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, and if it, in one sense, it failed, in another sense, I suppose you could say, ultimately,
yeah,
it succeeded.
Yeah. What happened is that, you know, he actually had a good idea. Most biographers before me have called him crazy for thinking he could dislodge the slavery system. But his idea really, if he had done it, if he had gotten away with it, it could have been effective. His idea was to free some slaves in the area and take these slaves into the mountains. These mountains ran very deep into the south. He knew them pretty well because he'd been a surveyor. And use the caves, the rocks, the cliffs, to hide out, and to make periodic kind of terror raids on southern plantations. And there was nothing that southerners feared more than slave revolts or slave escapes. And if suddenly there was all this insurrections, revolt going on among the slaves, caused by who knows, who's causing all this? It's a little bit like Bin Laden in the mountains. That he really hoped that he could bring the South to the point where the South would say, all right, let's compromise on this issue. Maybe we can have gradual emancipation here. Maybe we can compromise in some way with the North. This is becoming untenable, this institution, because there's just too much slave revolt going on here. So his idea was okay. The thing is, he did stall a little too long at Harper's Ferry, and so instead of escaping to the mountains, he was trapped by Robert E. Lee and his troops. And but in a sense, he succeeded, because then when he was hanged a couple of months later, he became a martyr. And when he was in prison, shortly before he was executed, he says, "I realized that the greatest thing I can do right now is to hang by the neck." You know, he said, that's what I yearn to do, and that's the greatest thing that I can do for the black race.
Mm-hmm. Martyr or terrorist, how do you see him?
I see him as a little bit of both. I see him more as a revolutionary than a terrorist, but I see him ultimately as a martyr. I really do. I think in Kansas he was more of a terrorist or a revolutionary, and then he was transformed really into an anti-slavery martyr by the end.
How was he able to get away with, if you will, what happened in Kansas at Pottawatomie?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that there had been 36 political murders committed between 1855 and 1858, and a lot of those murders went unredressed. And indeed, over 80% of the murders committed in the South over the slavery issue, that is to say, against white abolitionists who were visiting the South, who were lynched, murdered, or against free blacks, 80% of those went unredressed as well. So there was this kind of culture of anti-slavery and pro-slavery violence that and political murder that, in a sense, people could sort of do it and get away with it. But particularly in Kansas, where the legal system was in such disarray, he was pursued, but he gathered a band of people. He had about 25 followers at that time, and they stood off some federal troops that chased him, and he won actually a couple of armed battles after that of people who were trying to capture him. So.
Yeah.
When
he was hanged in 1859 for Harper's Ferry,
yeah.
How well known was the Pottawatomie incident?
It was fairly well known by that time, and a lot of biographers have, or people before me have said it wasn't known at all, otherwise nobody would have liked him. But it had been announced, described, along with John Brown's name, on the floor of the Senate in 1856, not long after it happened, and I've gone back. It was mentioned in the most popular newspaper of the day, the New York Herald, which was very anti-John Brown, and they mentioned, you know, he went in and slaughtered these five people. And it was mentioned by a very, very prominent public forum in Boston, this huge lecture hall where there was this anti-John Brown rally not long after the Harper's Ferry raid. So it was circulating. It was fairly well known. But it was also kind of considered part of the general confusion and chaos and murder going on in Kansas a couple of years earlier. It was known as Bleeding Kansas, and there was a reason why it was known as Bleeding Kansas, because a lot of blood was shed, and not just John Brown's murders.
Hmm. David Reynolds is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Seated Civil Rights. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. At his trial, for the raid on Harper's Ferry, there was an effort to raise a defense of insanity. Brown insisted he was not insane. Many people have argued otherwise. Was Brown deranged? How do we look at his mental state?
I don't find him insane. I really don't. A lot of people called him insane after his reputation sank, because what happened after the collapse of Reconstruction in 1876, there was that long period of segregation and discrimination, Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow, and that lasted until Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. And it was during that period that a lot of historians called him insane, paranoid, and so forth. But I've gone back and I've looked at all the documents. I've read all of his letters and journals. I don't see any signs of insanity there, that is to say, any kind of loss of concentration, any sense of delusion, any loss. He slept like a baby when he was in prison. Any loss of sleep. A lot of the signs of mental instability or something just weren't there. And when that insanity defense thing came up, he just stood up in court and said, you know, if I wanted to follow that, I would follow it. But I said, I don't feel in the least bit insane. I refused to follow that defense. I mean, he could have chosen that defense and maybe even gotten away with it, because it seems so insane. But his implicit implicit answer was, how about the country itself? The country itself had just passed a Supreme Court decision that said that blacks could never have any social rights. They were not citizens. They could never be citizens. That was the Dred Scott decision. And the country also held nearly 4 million blacks in slavery and quite often raping the women and dividing the families and murdering and torturing and so forth. So in that sense, which is more crazy, the country or John Brown? I'm convinced that at that time it was more the country that was crazy.
Yeah. At the same time, though, today, as I sit here and consider these issues and I think about John Brown and I think about how he saw God as the true judge and he was God's servant, and so therefore he was an enforcer of divine law, I find that troubling.
Well, it is troubling. And some of his rhetoric sounds like Bin Laden. Bin Laden says, "I was predestined by God to wage a jihad against the West," and all this stuff. And some of his rhetoric sounds a little bit like John Brown's. But the difference is that if Bin Laden were in power, if he were in power, he would create a Muslim theocracy, a radical Muslim theocracy, in which other views were excluded. John Brown counted among his closest followers Jews, agnostics, atheists, freethinkers, spiritualists, Protestants of different views than his. In other words, he was very open, not only racially open to people of different ethnicities, but to people of different religious viewpoints, even though he was very intense in his own particular religious viewpoint. He was very devoted and close to people of many different religious viewpoints. He was just against that one immoral institution of slavery. And I think there are certain situations, if someone were living in Hitler's Germany, if someone were living in Pol Pot's Cambodia, or let's say Mussolini's Italy, I think that in those particular cases, terrorism, anti-government terrorism, would be justified. And I think in John Brown's case, I think that it had come to the point where violence was really the only answer, unfortunately, sadly enough.
How do you think John Brown would look upon those who would advocate violence against doctors who perform abortion?
Well, some people have, Paul Hill, who was executed for murdering an abortion doctor, cited John Brown as a person who inspired him. And Timothy McVeigh also idolized John Brown, too. But I personally don't think that John Brown, if he were alive today in America, would use violence for any of the social issues that we confront today. Because most of the social issues that we have today are being debated politically, but they don't have the kind of stature of infamy, I think, that slavery had. Slavery was a unique situation, and I do not think he would approve of Paul Hill or Timothy McVeigh or others in recent times in America who have tried to use John Brown to support their radical violence.
Yeah. Well, the one thing you can say about John Brown is that his targets were very specific.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't...
Timothy McVeigh.
He wasn't doing the equivalent of bombing Oklahoma City government building in which there happened to be some babies and some innocent children. In fact, those murders in which he committed, he didn't just go in and slaughter people. He selected these people who were part of the pro-slavery local government or political party, and he went there, and there were many children there that he didn't touch, and the wives he didn't touch. He took the known pro-slavery fanatics of that area, and so there was a certain selectivity there, and the same thing in Harper's Ferry. He didn't actually intentionally commit go in there to commit murder. He wanted to take hostages and then take them to the mountains. So that was it wasn't like the equivalent of taking an airplane and running into these buildings in which there are so many thousands of innocent people of many different political viewpoints. So there was a selectivity there in the violence.
Well, one wonders then if you can say at all that John Brown was a terrorist if he did not believe in if the killing of civilians randomly was anathema to him.
Yeah, I mean that's why I said earlier I like to think of him more as a revolutionary against a corrupt system rather than as a terrorist. I say in my book, I suppose you could call him what Doris Lessing calls a good terrorist, but that word is problematic to use in his case. He did say that he wanted to create a reign of terror in the South from the mountains, so he did want to spark a certain form of terror through these guerrilla raids that he had planned to make from the mountains. So in that sense, and he did use the word terror there, so that's why some people do call him a terrorist. But you're right, it's a problematic word.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's joining us on the toll-free line on a cell phone. Line 4, go ahead.
Well, thank you for taking my call today. I guess I need to turn my radio down, huh? Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. I thank you for taking my call, Mr. Reynolds, and the lady, I'm not sure what her name is, but thank you anyway.
Hello.
I am a Missouri born Kansas, and I don't think there's no greater personality ever, hardly in the history of mankind, than John Brown. I'm also, a Cherokee African. And like I said, I will always have a certain degree of love in my heart for personalities like John Brown, specifically John Brown himself, because of what he stood for and what he was willing to put his life on the line for. And in a time when we hear about heroism and heroes, it's far-fetched. John Brown was an authentic hero who stood for something that was moral, decent, and just. And for somebody to suggest that he was a fanatic or anything of that nature, given the times and the circumstances of what he was fighting against, they're the ones who are insane and ludicrous. And I see many parallels today, what's going on with the Bush administration, people like that, who is a real authentic terrorist. And so what John Brown did in terms of taking up arms to fight the real terrorist, I feel like he was perfectly within his rights, and that's what we should all be doing if it comes to that.
Well, hopefully it won't come to that, but I basically agree with you, and I think if you read my book, John Brown, Abolitionist, you'll see a similar point of view of John Brown.
Well, I'm going to be sure and get your book, because I'm very much a John Brown fan. I'm a Missouri-born Kansas. I was born right there in that general area where all this turmoil was going on. I wasn't born, of course, then at the time, but yeah. I very much am, and I have a few men that I really would say were heroes, but John Brown really stands out as one who's a real authentic hero.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to reading your book, so and I think we're very much about them times again, but for different reasons.
Thanks for looking at my book, and I hope the rest of the listeners do that the same thing, and at least consider the other point of view, which is that he wasn't totally insane. He wasn't crazy.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, David Reynolds, author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to give us a call, join the discussion with a question or a comment, you're invited to do so. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line 1. Hello.
Hi, Professor Reynolds.
Yes.
The last caller was rather entertaining, but I'd like to remind him that as a Calvinist, John Calvin was a man who was totally in belief of theocracy and struggled his whole life for that.
Right.
And it's a little strange here because The contradictions are just monumental. What do you know about Frederick Douglass's attempt to win Brown over to the ideas of European scientific socialism? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. As you say, on the point of view of John Calvin, who was the founder of Calvinism, being a believer in theocracy, the difference was that John Brown was a Calvinist, but he was born after the American Revolution and the separation of church and state. So he was very much of a post-American Revolution Calvinist. That is to say, someone who was very devoted to Calvinistic Christianity, but was also very devoted to religious toleration and really anti-theocracy. So his was a very special brand of Calvinism. And Frederick Douglass always had a little bit of ambivalence about John Brown. He tried to... Frederick Douglass's first choice was not violence. Frederick Douglass refused to come to Harper's Ferry. And even though Frederick Douglass was part of the Secret Six of supporters of John Brown, after Harper's Ferry, he actually fled to England because he feared capture, being captured and being incriminated as part of the planning party of the Harper's Ferry raid. So there were disagreements between him and John Brown. Ultimately, I think history proved John Brown right because it did take the bloodiest war in our history to loosen the vice of slavery, to get rid of slavery. We also have to remember that Southerners in that day thought that slavery was a very Christian, beautiful thing. It was very good for blacks, it was very good for whites, so much so that many Southerners wanted to go to Africa and enslave all the Africans there to spread the blessings of Christianity and civilization over in Africa. So we have to put John Brown in that context.
Yeah. We're running down now on time. We only have a couple of minutes left. A question that you take up at the end of the book, where would we be today if it had not been for John Brown? Maybe we could end by ruminating on that question here a little bit.
Well, let's pretend that, there are so many what-ifs. What if the Civil War hadn't happened? If it had happened later, maybe the South would have won. People forget that twice during the war, the South almost won the war. So what would have happened if, in a later war, the South won the war? But anyway, let's pretend that we didn't have John Brown in the picture at all. Perhaps civil rights might have come a little bit later. And it seems to me that John Brown, stood for a moral principle. He went to rather extreme ends to enforce this moral principle. But everywhere I look today, I see versions of John Brown. I see John Brown's influence. Wherever I see people of different races, of different ethnicities, of different religions mixing together, I don't think we've totally achieved complete integration. I think it's naive to think that we were there yet, but I think that we're much, much closer today as a result of John Brown.
Hmm. How has the book been reviewed in the South?
Generally, it's been nicely good. A very nice review in Miami, a nice review in Atlanta, a very nice review in Alabama, a good review in Texas. Generally, the reviews all over have been very, very good. There was one Southerner, I forget what paper it appeared is in, who just hates John Brown, just detests him. And so that person thought I was being a kind of trendy historian or something like that, who was going over backwards or something in my sympathy, for what she called my sympathy for minorities. I thought that was a ridiculous statement and offensive. And I actually just that one case but generally the reviews there. It was the most widely reviewed book in America, by the way, for a week.
Really?
between in late April, it was the most widely reviewed book. So. The reviewers have been very, very positive and very encouraging, and I certainly hope your listeners will sample the book. The book should be in most bookstores. It's on Amazon and so forth. So,
yeah. Well, as I mentioned in my introduction when we began, a lot of the questions that are raised in this story resonate with us today.
Yes, absolutely.
Very much so, yeah. David Reynolds, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, Celeste, it's wonderful to have been here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. David Reynolds is the author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. The book is published by Knopf. And that was an interview from the archives. I talked with David Reynolds in July of this year. The program we had scheduled for this afternoon has been rescheduled for November 14th. On November 14th at 1:06, we'll talk with Zainab Salbi. She is the author of Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam. Again, that program now set for November 14th. Let's turn our attention now to what happened on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Here with the numbers from the CBOT, Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the corn pit drifted lower throughout a good portion of the day, finished down at $1.98 and a quarter in the nearby December contract, the low at $1.98, and what has been termed as fairly light trade. By the way, we'll talk with Paul Cooley this afternoon of ADM Investor Services. He's out of Oakland, Illinois. We'll take a look at this marketplace, try to discover what he thinks will happen in the near future and probably the distant future as well. Soy complex down 5 to 6 cents, then in a turnaround the first couple of days of the week where the bean complex had been trading higher. Now, from the wheat pit, futures in the nearby December contract down 2 cents for the day, had a high of 329, the low at 322 and three quarters, settled at 323 and a half. They were off two. March futures, 343 and a half in the wheat pit, the high, the low at 337 and a half, and Chicago wheat settled 338 and three quarters. They were off a penny and a half today. May futures, 351 and a half, the high, the low at 346 and one half, settled on that low, down 2.5 cents. July contract, the harvest month, $3.59 a bushel, the high, the low at 353, settled 0.75 cents above that at $3.53 and 0.75 cents, down 1 3/4 for the July wheat. September futures at the Chicago Board of Trade, 364, the high, the low at 361, settlement price there, 361 and a half, down a penny and a quarter for the September wheat. From the corn pit now, December contract had a high of $1.99 and a quarter today, a low at 198, settlement price at 198 and a quarter, down a penny and a quarter. March futures at 212 and three quarters on the high, the low at 211 and a half, a settlement price at 211 and three quarters, and they were down one. And the May contract, 221 and a quarter, the high, the low at 220 and a quarter, settlement price at $2.20 and a half cents, down three quarters. July futures, 228 and a half, the high, the low at 227 and a half, settled at $2.28, down a half cent. And September futures, 235 and a half, the high, the low at 235, settlement price at 235 and a quarter, they were down a half cent. December corn futures, 245 and a quarter on the high, the low at 44 and a half, and the settlement price at $2.44 and three quarters. They finished down 0.75 cents. December oat futures, 168 and a quarter, the high, the low at 163. Settlement at 163 and a quarter. They were off 3 3/4 today. And the March oats had a high today of 174 and a half, a low at 171. Settled at $1.71 even, down 2 3/4 for the day. Soy complex now. Nearby November bean futures, 578 and a half, the high, the low at 571. Nov bean settled 6.5 cents lower at $5.71 and a half cents. January futures, 591, the high, the low at 583. Settlement price at 583 and a half, down 6 3/4. And the March contract at 599 high, low at 592 and a quarter. Settlement price at 593, down 6 cents. And the May bean, 605, the high, the low at 598 and a quarter. Settled at $5.99, down 5.5 cents. July futures, 610, the high, the low at 603.5. Settlement price at 603 3/4, down 6.5 cents. And the August soybean, 608, the high, the low at 603. Settlement price at 603, they were down 6. Next year's November contract, down a nickel, 613.5, the high, the low at 609. The new November settled at 609.5, and once again, they were down a nickel for the day. Bean meal futures, December contract, 171.30, the high, the low at $169, settled $169.30, they were down $1.60 for the day. And the January futures in the bean meal pit, 172.80, the high, the low at 170.50, settlement price at 170.80, they were down 170. The other product, soybean oil, 23.53, the settlement price for the December contract, off 25 today. And settlement price once again at 23.53, the high at 23.67, the low at 23.41 for the DEES contract. And the January futures, a 23.89 high, low at 23.62, settled the January soybean oil at 23.72 from the Board of Trade, down 28 cents. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Well, livestock prices were lower today, just one exception, that being October feeder cattle. I'll have the numbers in just a second.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson and Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Here now are the numbers from the Merck. October feeder cattle, the high today 115.90, the low 115.45, the settlement 115.80, that up a nickel. November feeder cattle, 114.60, the high 113.60, the low 114, even the settlement, that down 27.5. January 113.05, the high 112.07.5, the low, the settlement 112.52.5, that down 12.5. October live cattle 88.85, the high 87.80, the low, the settlement 88.07.5, that down 77.5. December 91.05, the high 90.30, the low 90.52.5, the settlement, and that down 17.5. December lean hog 61.70, the high 60.05, the low, the settlement 60.07.5, that down 112.5. February 64.67.5, the high 63.45, the low, the settlement 63.77.5, that down 87.5. April lean hog 64.90, the high 64, even the low, the settlement 64.05, that down 85. May lean hog 65.80, the high 65, even the low 65.20, the settlement, that down 42.5. February pork bellies 89.35, the high, the low 86.10, the settlement 86.25, that down 210. The Dow off 4 points at 10,374. The S&P 500 off 2 at 1195. The NASDAQ is down 4 at 2105.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our technical director this afternoon, Jason Croft, the producer for the afternoon magazine, is Harriet Williamson. Coming up tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll talk about crows and their relatives. Did you know that some urban crows have learned to recognize a fast food logo? They will swoop in on refuse with the logo and pass over plain bags containing the same food. Crows and their relatives in the corvid family are very smart. They're also social creatures. So tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll talk about crows and humans. Our guests will be the authors of a new book from the Yale University Press, In the Company of Crows and Ravens, John Marsliff.